Hello, Kate. Are you there?
Hello. Yeah, I'm here. How are you?
Excellent. You have a topic for us?
I have a topic, yes.
All right.
So we're going to discuss The Beatles and McLuhan, Understanding the Electric Age by Thomas McFarlane. Or MacFarlane. I don't know how you say his name.
Right. Is that a new book?
No, it came out in 2013. And I remember when it was about to come out, I asked you what you thought of it, and you didn't think that you were going to like it. So I don't know if you ever looked at it.
No.
But you poo-pooed it at that time, so I never was interested in it. And then a friend of mine sent it to me last week. She loves the Beatles. She's crazy about the Beatles. And so she just asked me for my address, and she put a note on it that said, "Dear Katie, worlds collide," and sent it to me. So, of course, I read it because why not?
She knew you were into McLuhan.
Right, and I know she's into the Beatles.
Is she a baby boomer?
She's my age, so we're the last of the boomers, like 1964.
Right.
Yeah, very last boomer generation.
Yep.
She might be a little bit older than I am, but she didn't come of age when the Beatles were at the height of their career.
Right. But she never forgot them once she heard them at 10 years old or something.
Right, and still, she organizes a World Beatles Day in her community. I mean, she's really, 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 she's a super fan.
Yeah. She organizes a neighborhood thing?
I think she tries to make it bigger than that. I don't know what it is. She lives in Indianapolis, where I grew up, and I'm, of course, in Virginia now. But, she may probably on her Facebook at least once or twice every day, all the time, she posts something about the Beatles.
Okay, but so you should send me her name. I should go on there and maybe ask her somehow.
No, I'm not going to do that to her.
Look at that. Yes. Yeah, that's the right answer.
No,
Kate.
She wouldn't.
So you're still Kate.
What's that?
Yeah, that's the right answer. You're still Kate.
No, I'm Katie. You get me mixed up
Katie.
With you get mixed me
yeah,
mixed up with Chad's Kate. No, I'm Katie.
That's right.
That's
right,
okay.
Right.
I like.
Well, you know, her email
her.
Is Katie. That's what screws it up.
Yeah.
When I address Kate, her email is Katie, and then when I get you, I get back. I get all backwards. So
it's fine.
You're just
going
to have to call in more regularly.
Yeah.
What?
I think it bothers her more than it bothers her that you call her Katie more than it bothers me when you call me Kate. I really don't care. You can call me whatever you want.
All right.
So do you want me to tell you about the author? I'll tell you about the author. Then let me give you an overview of what he's talking about. And then if it's still interesting, we can go through and we can talk about some of the chapters. It's a fairly short book, very dense.
Now, one thing to keep in mind, Katie, is Lennon gets the shot December 9th, I think, 8th or 9th, 1980, and McLuhan dies 3 weeks later, and they're both the archetypes of the pre-Reagan world. And they died right after Reagan got elected. And Mae Brussel predicted, right as soon as Reagan got elected, November 1980, we got trouble, look out, rock musician. She gave out a damn warning to the rock musicians in general that they could get killed. And then Lennon died.
Okay, well, he got shot, and then Marshall had, a stroke, and then he never recovered? Isn't that how he died?
Yeah, he had a stroke a year, September 26, 79, and he died in his sleep on the last day of 1980, going into New Year's Day.
Okay, so how are those deaths related? I mean, how are they related?
Well, you know that John and Yoko visited McLuhan in 69.
Yeah, and that interview is transcribed in this book. So I read it, and then it's up on YouTube, so I watched it, too.
Yes.
So,
yeah, McLuhan wasn't that good of an interviewer. He was kind of stiff.
Well, it wasn't really an interview. There was no MC. They just kind of hung out and talked for a little while.
Yes, yeah. And I found he wasn't very flexible, or he just was stiff. He didn't have the sensitivity of interviewers of the next couple of generations.
Who, Marshall didn't or John?
Guy. What?
Who was stiff? McLuhan or Lennon?
McLuhan. McLuhan was very stiff.
Yeah, because Michael, his son, was doing dope.
No, this is 1969. Good point.
He predicted
yeah.
that these two misfits were going to corrupt his son and make him go to jail.
And he went to court.
He did.
Yeah. That's around 69, yes, 69, 70. Anyways, McLuhan, people who knew him in the 50s, like Ted Carpenter, said that McLuhan never really got his fluid self back that he had in the 50s. Once he had that health problem in 1960, and where McLuhan even said he wished he died, he said his work had been done, but they kept him alive. And then he had the longest brain surgery in history of humanity on November 25th, 67, and he didn't really get his mojo back after that. But for most people, McLuhan was still powerful.
But didn't he write all about the laws of media after that surgery?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, well, that was something. I mean, that's the thing that has lasted the most.
Yes, but the laws of media were already developed in rudimentary form in 1960 in his report for the National Association of Educational Broadcasters in the United States. They're called the SISC charts, that's sensory impact / sensory closure charts. You can look at them if you ever buy what's called understanding media and report to something. So the slang term for it is Project 69. That's what McLuhan called it, Project 69. So he was almost countering John Kennedy's 9-year goal to get to the moon, which was happened in 69. McLuhan said, oh, no, the moonshots are puny compared to what I'm talking about, what we can harness with the laws of media. Yeah, so that's maybe why he called it Project 69.
Well, I didn't think, and we'll go back to the book in a second, but I didn't think in the discussion with John and Yoko that it was really the fact that McLuhan was stiff. And I could be really heavily biased because, I mean, I'm not really a fan of the Beatles. I'm not a fan. And, I mean, certainly they influenced me just because I'm in the world and they've influenced so much. But, like, I'm not super familiar with their oeuvre. If I've, like, heard the songs, great, but I've never, it's never sent me. I'm not super moved by them. And then, so of course, I'm kind of biased because I just assume that the things that people say about Yoko Ono are true, that she, you know, broke up the band or whatever.
Not that, they're not that fluid. They're stiff, too.
I mean, I thought the conversation was really missing. Like, if she hadn't been sitting there, I thought it would have been better between John and Marshall.
Yeah,
but she kept trying to insert her own
art world mystique. And Lennon was just sort of being drawn into that world, so he was following her lead. So he was intuiting letting Yoko talk. You know, it was over Lennon's head in a way. Yoko was doing. Maybe that's 1969. They'd just been together a couple of years, 66. They became heroin addicts in 68, you know. People don't talk about that.
They got into heroin. Well, they had just gotten married, I thought, because they were doing those bed-ins. And so
That's the spring of 69. I guess they got married after they recovered from the heroin. I don't know how addicted they were, but they were doing it. And they had met on Lennon's birthday, October 9th, 1966, and then they're together, and then they get married in the spring of 69, and then they tour around doing the bed-in in Montreal. Tim Leary shows up to that, and then they visit Trudeau and McLuhan in December 69 because they're in a concert in Toronto of 50s bands, old bands. Yes, Carol?
Yeah, it makes me wonder if they thought they were doing a minuscule reappearance like we did properly. They were pretending to die and then reappear.
Well, people always said John and Yoko reminded them of us.
Ooh.
Yeah, Flappy didn't say that.
I agree with Carolyn. Ooh.
Yeah. It was based on, in his Playboy interview in 1980, that came out the month he was shot, I think, the month after, it's based on that they were into mediums and psychics, especially Yoko. So my friend thought that's what he thought we were.
Oh.
And so they were taking the Thompson quadrant view of me, and they thought that those two were getting into that. And then Yoko did get into health food, and John Cage says she saved his life. by getting him to be a macrobiotic person in the 80s, maybe, 70s or 80s. You know John Cage?
No.
Who's that? He's the famous abstract modern composer. He's famous for doing pieces which consist of nothing but silence for 4 minutes and 32 seconds or something. Yeah, you don't know about John Cage. You have to know about him. He was a really good friend of McLuhan and Marcel Duchamp and Bucky Fuller and everybody in the 60s. What'd you say, Carol? No, he just did all. He did environmental happenings. He did any kind of music. Now, we saw him perform in 1982 in Toronto. He did his translation of Finnegan's Wake based on McLuhan and Eric's Ten Thunders of Finnegan's Wake. So you read his books called Silence and A Year from Monday, I think it is, put out in the 60s. They're very good because he talks about how he relates McLuhan to music.
This is relating McLuhan to music, too.
Yes.
So,
right, this will be the other. Well, we'll see what the book says.
We'll see. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know what you're going to think of it. It was okay. I mean, I wasn't riveted. It's highly academic, short but very dense. And, I mean, I think I have some bias toward it because I'm kind of like, meh. And you had said that it wasn't going to be good.
That's M-E-H?
Yeah, I'm kind of M-E-H about it.
You'll see that, Carol, among those born in 64. They use that a lot.
And the hardcover book, even though it's only like 150 pages, I'm sure Faith didn't buy me one of the expensive copies, but it's like $60. I'm like, you sure are proud of this book. It's really just kind of like a paper. And then, you know, it just is so proud of the fact that this work also features the first published transcripts ever of the complete filmed conversation between John Lennon and Marshall McLuhan on their respective ideas. And I'm like, so you typed up, I mean, big deal. So you typed up a transcript that's on YouTube. I mean, I don't know why you're so proud of that. You want people to pay $60 for it. But anyway, I will read it and call in to Payday, which... That's good enough for me. It's a good enough reason to call into Payday. That's a good thing.
Well, I'm interested in the academic point of view it's got. So let's hear its thesis.
Okay, so do you want to hear about Thomas McFarlane first?
Yes.
Let me read you his
bio. Yeah.
So Thomas McFarlane completed his PhD in music composition at NYU Steinhard. Is that how you say that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
His doctoral dissertation, The Abbey Road Medley, Extended Forms in Popular Music, focused on the role of recording technology in the compositional style of the Beatles. He subsequently transformed his findings into a book that was published by the Scarecrow Press in November 2007. As a composer, Professor McFarlane's works have been performed at venues in Italy, Hungary, Romania, and the United States. He continues to explore the creative possibilities engendered by the advent of recorded sound. In October 2012, Professor McFarlane published a second book entitled The Beatles and McLuhan, Understanding the Electric Age, a work that employed the ideas of media ecologist Marshall McLuhan to explore the poetic implications of multi-track recording. So that's what we're going to talk about. This book featured the first published transcription of the complete filmed conversation between John Lennon, Yoko Ono, and Marshall McLuhan on their respective ideas, as well as an interview with Marshall McLuhan's son and executor, Michael McLuhan, on his father's and the Beatles' legacy. So that interview is in the book, too, which is pretty interesting. Currently, Professor McFarlane is conducting research for the first volume of a study on the works of singer-composer Billy Joel. Professor McFarlane has given presentations and seminars at the University of Leeds, the University of Glamorgan at Cardiff, and the University Paris Sorbonne. He teaches MPAP courses in music theory and composition, supervises research in colloquy music for music and music education, and also teaches the performing arts in Western civilization with Director Emeritus Dr. Lawrence Ferrara. In the fall of 2013, he became the MPAP Music Education Administrative Coordinator under the aegis of Dr. John Gilbert, Director of Music Education at NYU Steinhardt. Couldn't find a single picture of him. Couldn't find any other information other than this bio printed in other places.
What was his PhD about?
Music composition.
Yeah, but what was the full title?
It just says music composition. Completed his PhD
what?
In music composition.
Wow, that's his PhD.
Yeah.
And then the Beatles thing is something different.
Right. So he's into like looking at popular music.
Yeah.
So just an overview of the book. So he has a beginning chapter that's quite boring that goes on and on and on about why he wanted to do this. so we're not going to talk about that.
Right.
Then in part one, he talks about living in acoustic space. So he's getting into some of McLuhan's basic ideas in chapter one. He talks about notes from the electric age. And it seems like he's got like a kind of a good overview of McLuhan's stuff. I mean, certainly nothing even close to anything that you would do, but like a good, you know, a good popular overview of the books that Marshall wrote, his life, and really focusing on the laws of media. Like, that's what he uses throughout the whole thing to do his analysis of this recorded music.
Okay.
So he talks a little bit about preliterate and electric communications, and right away gets into the fact that the medium matters to more than the message, like that we're going to be influenced by the media. So he gets right into that and talks about some of the basic metaphors that McLuhan used, specifically Global Village.
Yeah.
And he talks about how McLuhan described the Global Village as an acoustic space of all at oneness and simultaneous happening.
Right.
And that
it should be all at onceness, not oneness, a oneness.
Well, it is oneness. I misspoke.
Yeah.
He did not. All at onceness. I'm sorry. Simultaneous happening. And then how it produces an electric media environment that will create new forms of interdependence and reverse the ascendancy of the visual with the aural as the primary sensory input. So,
is the word tactility or tactile used?
No.
See, there's a big deficiency. The guy doesn't even get to the 60s if he doesn't talk about tactility, because acoustic is the 1920s and 30s. That's the content of radio. So,
right. Well, he seemed to be trying to get us right into the fact that the electric age is going to make sure that we're listening to things instead of seeing them, and then he doesn't take it any further. No synesthesia, nothing like that. But that's okay.
His purposes. Does it at the in the index? Have McLuhan's name and then pages. Could you give us what's the best shot of a quote?
Yeah.
What's a good quote that he might have?
And I did look at that because I had a feeling that you might want to know, and it seems like actually he got a lot of his ideas about McLuhan from McLuhan's Wake. You know that movie?
The movie, yes. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which, I mean, that's a good overview, but it's so basic. So let's
see. It's not actually good. You always have to check with Don Thiel. Is it good, Don? No, Bob, not good movie. Okay, Don,
dude.
Good.
I'm gonna look and see if Don's even in here.
No, nobody is.
No, he's
Don.
Not, of course.
He knows
okay,
too much.
So you want me to read you the Marshall McLuhan references?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
couple,
McLuhan Marshall, At the Flip Point of Time, The Point of More Return, Journal of Communication, 25, number 4. So he's reading journals. Not necessarily books. The Classical Trivium, The Place of Thomas Nash and the Learning of His Time. Culture is Our Business. The Gutenberg Galaxy, The Making of Typographic Man, no page number listed. The Invisible Environment, The Future of Erosion. The Mechanical Bride. The Medium in the Light. Understanding Media. There's no page numbers. They're just listed as
that's all that's under his name? He doesn't give particular page numbers for a quote?
No, because I'm looking at the bibliography. And there's,
don't
no
look at that. See if there's a table of an index at the back where it names people and gives the page numbers. And you go to the page. It doesn't have that?
But it just says where Marshall's talked about in his book, in this book. So if you wanted to see where
Marshall... We're looking to see what quotes he used. How sophisticated is his selection?
Well, after I give the overview, I started some places we can go through. You want to do that?
Yeah,
okay,
do the
let me just finish
overview.
The overview, and then we'll go. Then I start places for you to trash, actually. I'm just being funny, but. Okay, so then he also mentions McLuhan's concept of the electoral environment in which it's a place where you no longer had to be anywhere in order to do everything.
Right.
Which is pretty popular. So then he starts talking about how by 1966, the Beatles were the most famous and influential rock music group, and he states that they knew exactly what McLuhan meant. And I didn't buy that.
No, they
don't. I think that that maybe for the purposes of this paper, he calls them like perfect McLuhanites. But I don't think the Beatles knew that they were. Why are you laughing?
No, this is why the guy he goes from there to Billy Joel. I mean, that's not too cool, right? To go to Billy Joel. So
this
is a milquetoast guy.
Well, yeah, we knew it. We knew it was going to be that.
No, not necessarily. No, I mean he has read McLuhan, so he's doing something. For people. Yeah, no, anyway, that would totally disagree.
I mean, I don't know how many people are reading this book.
Beg your pardon?
I don't know how many people are reading this book.
Mm. Right.
You know?
Okay, let's continue.
Okay, so he says that the Beatles knew exactly what McLuhan meant. And then he gets into talking about how they couldn't give live concerts anymore. It was increasingly difficult for them to perform in concert the complex multi-track sonic textures that they were exploring in the recording studio. And so at the height of their success, they retired from the concert stage, and then they were just recording songs because they couldn't perform anymore. He also talks about how one time when they tried to perform, the crowd was so loud that you couldn't even hear their music. And so it was more about the audience than it was about them.
But Katie, Zappa got around that. He just trained his musicians to play it right and drowned out the audience.
Yeah,
well,
one quote this book will not have, Katie,
mm-hmm.
is when John Lennon, after the Beatles broke up, he got interviewed by Jan Wenner of the Rolling Stone magazine. And in that interview, John Lennon said, "I'd rather have been Frank Zappa."
Well, and it's interesting because since I hadn't been calling in for such a long time, I did listen to the last couple shows just to kind of see what people were talking about. And so I've been listening to you talk about Zappa because you were talking about it so much in the last couple of shows. And it was interesting to me that in this book, talking about the Beatles, they literally were saying that it was all about the audience. And Frank was saying he doesn't care about the audience at all. He was writing for himself.
Right, yeah.
So I thought that was an interesting contrast. And then we're going to get into this in a little bit, but he's also talking about how with the multi-track recording, one of the things that's special about it and makes it so appropriate for the electric age is that you're not writing down the music anymore. So it removes the alphabet part. And Frank wrote everything out. Like, he just sat there without a shirt smoking, like writing and writing and writing and writing like crazy. No.
Yeah, but Frank also allowed improvisation within his compositions.
He still like heard music in his head and transferred that. He was a composer. It wasn't just like experimenting with sound on a recording device. So in that sense, they're different. Does that make sense?
Right. It does. And this guy doesn't write a good book unless you juxtapose Zappa versus John. That's the dialectic of the 60s. And McLuhan, and they both had read McLuhan. They didn't have a perfect understanding of McLuhan, but they both were, quote, influenced by McLuhan. And that would make an interesting book. But this guy doesn't know enough. He went through mainstream education and never heard of Ion and all that leads from there. So, too bad. But anyways, we're going to talk about him anyway.
It's all right. It's still, there's value to it. So then he gets into talking about figure and ground. So he talks about how McLuhan described ground as a configurable surface from which figures arise and recede. And then he talks about considering ground as acoustic space, another McLuhan metaphor,